16. Worthy opponent. They didn't, couldn't say a word as the Jade Saber approached the now yellow and green planet known as Belkaden. Luke and Mara had done their homework on the way to the planet, and they held no doubts, with visual inspection looming before them, that something on the planet had gone terribly, terribly wrong. It wasn't the lack of response, other than the incredible amounts of static, whenever they tried to hail the scientific outpost, X-Gal-4. In truth, any response would have surprised them, for merely in observing the planet they knew. Belkaden was, to their way of looking at things, dead. "What were they doing at that station?" Mara asked. "Observations," Luke replied. "Just staring out at the galactic rim." "That's what X-Gal tells the public," Mara said skeptically. Luke turned to regard her. "You think this is an experiment gone wrong?" "Can you think of anything else that might have done this?" Mara asked. "You've read the reports on Belkaden, full of huge trees and small seas, and with clear air and blue skies. The only thing that kept the place from being more appealing was the rather difficult animals that called it home. The reports from the station indicated that they lived behind protected walls," Luke agreed. "So if animals had found their way in and destroyed the station, it wouldn't be so surprising," Mara reasoned. "Do you know any animals that could cause this?" She waved her hand at the viewport and the curving line of Belkaden's horizon and the roiling, noxious-looking clouds. "The reports from their headquarters on Coruscant and from this particular station gave no hints that anything more than observation was going on here," Luke said. But his tone wasn't so firm. How could it be, with such devastating evidence as the view before them? Something had gone very wrong down there, something brutal, and Luke understood that such catastrophes were usually the work of reasoning beings. Mara glanced down at her console's smaller view screen, scrolling the information of the composition of the clouds. "Carbon dioxide and methane, mostly," she explained, and that came as no surprise to either her or Luke. "In tremendous concentrations. Even if there is a layer of breathable air below, it would be too hot down there to support much life." Luke nodded. "We've got to go down and see." Mara didn't disagree, but her concerned look was not lost on Luke. Neither was her color. Luke had noted that Mara's complexion had paled as they had approached Belkaden, and he could sense a bit of her internal weakening. The flight from Dubrillion had been easy enough, but Luke now feared that all of this, the trip to the Outer Rim, the tour of Lando's incredible city, and now the journey out here to Belkaden, might be proving too taxing for his wife. "We can call back and do a few more readings," Luke offered instead. "X-Gal will muster the right ships to come out and see what happened here." "We're here now," Mara pointedly reminded. Luke shook his head. "We haven't got the right equipment," he explained. "We can do the preliminary scan and relay that information, but the Jade Saber isn't really built for flying into that mess." Mara's expression shifted from surprised to angry as she came to the obvious conclusion that Luke was trying to protect her. "The Jade Saber can fly through a firestorm," she replied. "She can blow a starfighter out of the sky and run circles around star destroyers. She's as good a shuttle as anyone will find, and better than anything X-Gal will put together." "Neither of us are trained in," Luke started to say. "There might be people still down there," Mara harshly interrupted. "They might even be hearing our call, but unable to respond. So we should just fly away, back to the safety of Lando's planet?" "Nothing with Lando is ever safe," Luke replied with a half-hearted smile, a feeble attempt to lighten the mood. "But he does have doctors, right?" Mara said sarcastically, "because we need doctors." "Doctors?" Luke echoed, but the word died on his lips, for he knew Mara had seen right through him and his attempts to protect her, and that this, above anything else in all the galaxy, brought up the fires in the independent woman. Luke could yell at her, even insult her, during their occasional arguments, and she'd give it back to him tenfold, but never ever would Mara Jade Skywalker accept condescension. She was ill, true, but she would not be treated as if she was incapacitated. Their course now seemed obvious. Their duty compelled them down to the planet, to the outpost to rescue survivors, or perhaps to retrieve bodies, and to retrieve as well any information that might tell them what had happened to Bell Cotton. Luke buckled his harness tight about him. "It'll be a rough ride down," he remarked. But he understood that for him the ride down to Bell Cotton wouldn't be half as bad as the ride back to Lando's might have been had he insisted on it. As soon as the Jade Saber broke the rim of Belkaden's atmosphere, Luke understood just how much his last words had been an understatement. Violent winds buffeted the shuttle, and some unforeseen electromagnetic imbalance sent the sensors and other instruments screaming out error messages and alarm bells. Systems failed and then came back online. At one point, there was a sudden drop to the right, and both Luke and Mara thought their harness belts would cut right through them. Behind them, secured in a pod much like his seat on Luke's X-Wing, R2-D2 screeched and chattered. A few seconds, which seemed like hours, later, they broke through the roiling clouds and hit an air pocket that put them into a straight drop for nearly 1,000 meters before they slammed back to a stable ride. Then they saw the devastation, the reddish-brown forest, streaming lines of noxious vapors skyward. Mara hit Luke with a succession of questions concerning air quality and wind speed and altitude, but her co-pilot could only shake his head, having no answers, for none of the instruments were giving him plausible readings. He looked back to R2-D2 and asked the droid to try to make some sense of it, and R2-D2's answer scrolled across the screen, a jumble of incoherent letters and symbols. "Are you all right?" Luke asked the droid pointedly. R2-D2 whistled like a drunken pirate. "Do you see that?" Mara interrupted, indicating the data screens. Luke moved in close and read carefully. "Sulfur," he said, and looked up. "A volcano?" "If we're going out, we're going to need breath masks," Mara remarked. They were flying manually now, by sight and by gut. Mara shut off all heads-up displays, leaving the screen open for normal viewing, and brought them lower, the swift shuttle skimming the treetops. "Any idea of where we'll find that station?" she asked. Luke, his eyes closed as he delved into emanations from the Force, replied, "We have the coordinates, but that won't do us much good without instruments." "Are you feeling anything?" "Belkaden's not dead," Luke replied. "It's just different." That much seemed evident to Mara as she stared out the window at the living trees emanating the fumes. She thought for a moment to fall into the insight of the Force as well, but seeing the perplexed look on her husband's face, changed her mind and concentrated on her flying instead. She turned the shuttle north and brought it up, just under the cloud level, accelerating to a swift flight. "We won't spot anything from here," Luke reasoned. "Not even a distress signal." He stopped his complaining a moment later, though, when he came to understand Mara's thinking, when the thick air gradually began to thin as they approached Belkaden's northern pole, an ice cap that seemed far less substantial than the documents about Belkaden had indicated it would be. It seemed as if the increased heat on the planet was already making a difference. "Oh, smart woman," Luke said with a smile. The ride smoothed out, and the cloud cover thinned even more, and the instruments came back online a little bit, and enough for the two to get some fix on the exact polar coordinates. Using these as their base, they turned in line for the coordinates of the X-Gal station, eyeing landmarks along their way, even downloading an image of the mountains along that general line. Off they went, up high again and straight toward target. R2-D2 kept the calculations going, measuring speed and, thus, distance, and within minutes the droid could calculate their coordinates closely enough to know that they were in the vicinity of the X-Gal station. Mara executed a few long banking turns, trying to spot the station amidst the jungle canopy, while Luke alternated between looking and feeling. It was in one of those Force-sensitive transitions that the Jedi found their answer. "Left," he told Mara, "about 30 degrees." She didn't ask, just turned. "Hold it steady," Luke told her, feeling the sensation growing. Warmer, warmer. Over that rise, he announced, opening his eyes, and sure enough, as soon as the jade saber crested the ridge, a thin tower came into sight, and a walled compound behind it. Exgal 4, Mara announced. Patiently awaiting his retrieval to a position of more immediate value, Yeoman Carr heard the whine of the Jade Saber's powerful drives as the shuttle made its first pass overhead. He got to a window in time to see the ship's second pass, and though he, like his people, was no supporter of anything purely technological, he had to admit that this ship, with its sleek fish-head design and swept-back tail fin and its flared side pods protecting the twin ion drives, was among the most beautiful he had seen. It cut the vapor trails with hardly a wake and with movement swift and sure. Smiling with satisfaction, the previously bored warrior strapped on his Von Doom crab shell-plated armor and his bandolier of flying thud bugs, did a quick check of his pouch of sentient and binding blorash jelly, and took up his amphistaff, another living creature, a vicious serpent that could harden all or part of its body to the consistency of stone, including narrowing its neck and tail so that they would cut like a razor, or could become supple and whip-like for its Yuuzhan Vong master. In the hands of a true warrior like Yeoman Carr, the amphistaff could become a deadly missile weapon as well, a spear to hurl, or it could spit forth a stream of venom 20 meters with stunning accuracy, blinding opponents instantly and killing them slowly over many agonizing hours as the poison seeped in through pores and wounds. Back at the window, Yeoman Carr watched the sleek shuttle put down just outside the compound walls. The Yuuzhan Vong warrior's smile was genuine. He was going to enjoy this. They came out of the security of the Jade Saber tentatively, and none more so than R2-D2, who was so concerned with the eerie and dangerous surroundings that he failed to pay enough attention to his companions and kept bumping into Luke. They couldn't stay on the planet for long, they knew, even with their breath masks, for it was too hot, and every step would literally suck the moisture right out of them. Mara started for the compound door, but Luke noted something off to the side by the tower and pulled her by the arm that way. As they approached, they noticed that all the ground in the area was covered by strange-looking little reddish-brown beetles. "They're all dead," Luke noted, stepping gingerly over the crunchy insects. And R2-D2 blew whistles of protest and flat-out refused to follow, until, of course, something hidden deep in the jungle canopy roared, and then the little droid zoomed through the beetle cluster, crunching them up with his wheels, spraying the tiny carcasses up into the air in his wake. "But it's not the air, apparently," Mara noted, turning a glance toward the jungle canopy. "Some of the creatures have survived." "Well, if some of the creatures have survived, then so should the people inside the station. Some of them, at least. Unless what we're hearing are new creatures, adapted to the atmosphere," Mara noted, and she checked a gauge at the side of her collar and shook her head. She and Luke might be able to breathe without help from their equipment, but the air was certainly of terrible quality. The three moved to the wall, toward the gate showing, on this side of the compound, a stained metal door. "Blood," Mara noted. Luke pulled open the casing of the security lock to the side. "Tap in the codes," he ordered R2-D2. The droid started for the box, but Mara whipped out her blaster and put a shot right into the contraption, frying it. The metal door resounded with the click of lock tumblers disengaging. "Direct?" Luke noted sarcastically. "What's it going to hurt?" Mara asked. Luke conceded the point with a shrug and kicked the door open, leading the way in. The compound was deserted, a sight made even more eerie by the sharp contrast caused by the vivid light filtering through the cloud cover. "Empty dock," he noted, pointing to the space vacated by the departure of the spacecaster. "Could be just for landing supply ships," Mara reasoned. R2-D2 put in a series of clicks and whirs. "True enough," Luke agreed. "They'd have to have some way to get up to their satellites' telescopes, and to get off-planet, if necessary." "It doesn't get any more necessary than this," Mara noted dryly. "Whether they left or not, There are data banks inside, Luke remarked, leading the way toward the main building. We'll get some answers. R2-D2 zipped right behind him, and Mara was fast to follow, though she paused a few steps later and bent down, finding yet another of the strange beetles. This one, unlike all the others, was still alive, though undeniably groggy and slow. She carefully picked it up and brought it close before her eyes, noting a clear liquid oozing from the end of its tiny mandibles. "What is it?" Luke asked, turning back to see his wife with the beetle in her hand and an intense look upon her face. Mara shook her head slowly, her gaze locked on the little creature and its wriggling legs and clapping mandibles. "You think that these bugs are somehow related to this disaster?" Luke asked. To his distress, Mara, instead of answering, wiped her finger across the mandibles, collecting some of the oozing liquid, then brought the finger right before her eyes. "There's something about this," she said slowly. "Probably poison," Luke reasoned. Again, Mara slowly shook her head. "Something different," she tried to explain, and her voice seemed to falter. "I don't know." Luke noted how hollow her eyes seemed, as if the beetle or this planet was somehow draining her. He wanted to ask if she was all right, but wisely held the question, reminding himself that his capable wife didn't need his worry. Inside, the station was quiet and dim and cooler, and with air that was much more breathable. Also, many lights, mostly panel indicators, were still on, and those quiet, usually indiscernible background sounds, the hum of computer drives and glow lamps, permeated the air. "It's like a tomb," Mara said, and both she and Luke instinctively recoiled from the mere volume of her voice, the sudden breaking of constant low-level hum. "Let's find the main computer so that R2 can tap in," Luke suggested. "Everything still seems to be functioning," Mara remarked as they started on their way, padding down the darkened corridors with all speed, for none of them wanted to stay in this place any longer than absolutely necessary. They turned corner after corner, opening every door they passed. Both Luke and Mara had their lightsabers in hand, though when they noticed each other poised as if expecting an attack, they both put on curious expressions. Logically, there should be no danger here. But something about the atmosphere of the place, the panel lights glowing in the darkened rooms. "Here it is," Luke called, pushing open one door to reveal a large circular room. "Great setup," Mara remarked when she entered, seeing the array of the 7 control pods. "And the place is still alive," Luke added. "So where is everybody?" R2-D2 rolled into the room, down the ramp from the refreshment dais, and onto the main floor. He went to the nearest pod and extended his computer interface, linking up. "Download everything they've got," Luke instructed, and the droid beeped and clicked his agreement. Luke replaced his lightsaber on his belt, then moved to the pod next to R2-D2. Mara did likewise and moved to the central command pod, and both of them went to work trying to determine the condition of the equipment. It was all working, they soon understood, but no clear signals were coming through from the orbiting satellites, or from anything else, it seemed. "It's the cloud cover," Luke remarked. "Nothing's getting through." "And maybe no distress signal could get out," Mara added. Luke nodded. "That'll take a few minutes," he said to her, drawing her gaze to the droid. "Let's go and see if we can find anybody." The two had grown more comfortable with the place by then, and so they thought nothing of leaving R2-D2 alone in the big room, or of splitting up once outside the room, so that they could cover more ground. R2-D2, though, didn't share that level of comfort. He began whistling a tune more nervous than sing-songy, while he continued his work on the download, trying every trick he knew to extract the information more quickly. Maybe the whistling would help. There was no one about, and given the blood on the entry gate, Mara thought nothing of walking into formerly private quarters. She checked lockers and closets, even coat pockets and private desks. In one room she found some scribbled notes in an old-fashioned flimsoplast journal, dated just over a week earlier, describing the increasingly foul air and the inability of the station to raise any communications off-planet, or even to find the feeds from the satellites. The writer went on to detail the investigation to this point, how someone named Yeoman Carr kept saying that this was all a passing weather oddity. The page ended ominously. Perhaps it is natural, but I believe it is linked to... To what? Mara asked aloud in frustration. She ruffled the flimsoplast but found no further writing, then opened the desk drawer to see more unused flimsoplast, some metal clips, writing utensils, a couple of data cards, and some small bottles. She reached for the data cards, thinking there might be more information there, but paused as one of the bottles caught her eye. She turned it about so that she could better see its contents. A beetle. Mara took the beetle she had collected outside out of her pouch, comparing the two. They were the same species, obviously, and that made her wonder even more if these creatures were somehow connected to the disaster. Had this scientist suspected the same thing? Did he believe the disaster linked to the beetles? She took the journal and the bottle and headed back into the hallway, turning to follow in the direction Luke had gone. A screech from behind from R2-D2 in the control room turned her fast the other way. The droid wasn't trying to interpret the information. As he absorbed it, was merely trying to make the transfer as fast as possible. He was well on his way, figuring the download to be about 70% complete, when he swiveled his domed head about and saw the dark, caped figure rise up from behind a low railing at the side of the room. He knew at once that it wasn't Luke or Mara, and hoped that it was just one of the missing scientists. No such luck, as the droid discovered when the figure came out of the shadows, leaping atop one of the pods in the front row. Clad in some dark-plated armor, unlike anything R2-D2 had ever seen, and holding a snake-headed staff. He roared at R2-D2, a stream of curses and snarls. Infidel! Perversion! Sacrilege! And stomped his foot down on the console, sending up a spray of sparks. R2-D2 tried desperately to flee, but he did so before he disengaged his interface connection. And so, when he then tried to pull free, his bulk was twisted at the wrong angle. The droid whistled and beeped, trying to call for help. The caped menace pulled something from the bandolier about his chest and threw it, or rather, simply let it go. R2-D2 wheeled back the other way, his interface connection disengaging even as it tugged back, and the resulting abrupt shift toppled the droid onto his side. And just in time, for the flying thing zoomed past, smashing into the pod, driving right into it, and R2-D2 screeched. His dome swiveled about to look up, and there was the warrior standing above him, staff poised for a destroying blow. "Yow!" the droid squealed and rolled to the side. The door at the back of the room banged open and Mara rushed in. "Stop!" she cried. "We are not your enemies!" Her words trailed away as the figure leapt away from the pod closer to her to stand in all his warrior glory, dark armor gleaming, his disfigured face staring coldly at the woman. And what unnerved Mara most of all was the feeling inside her gut that this warrior, this monster, somehow knew her. The two stood and stared for a long while, neither blinking, the test of wills before the inevitable battle. Off to the side, R2-D2 managed to manipulate his torso, pushing against the console while extending his arm to upright himself. He skittered right off, but the noise alerted the caped warrior, and he launched another missile. Was it some kind of bug? The droid's way, this one clipping the console right behind the fleeing R2-D2, showering him with sparks and bringing forth another frantic yow. Mara reached for her lightsaber, but, recalling her weakened state, drew her blaster instead and had it leveled the warrior's way before he turned back to face her. "It is an abomination," he growled. "It's a droid," she corrected. "Exactly my point," the warrior replied with a wicked grin. "An abomination, a sign of the weakness that pervades your people." "My people?" Mara asked. "Who are you?" "I am Yeoman Carr, the harbinger of doom," he said with a sinister laugh. "I am the beginning of the end for your people." Mara's face screwed up with incredulity. "Do not mock me," Yeoman Carr roared, and he pulled another thud bug from his bandolier and let it fly at Mara. She took a shot at it, but it dodged, and then she had to dive aside once and then again as it swooped around. It started to loop for a third pass, but this time she got her aim and blew it out of the air. Yeoman Carr continued to laugh. Mara turned her blaster on him. "I think you'll be coming with me," she said. He laughed louder and started to reach for his bandolier. "Don't make me," she warned, raising the blaster threateningly. He just laughed and continued, and she shot him. But the magnificent plated armor turned the blast aside. Eyes wide with disbelief, Mara had to move again, and quickly, as Yeoman Carr tossed out another thud bug, and another and another. She wisely abandoned her blaster, tossing it aside and drawing out her lightsaber. Then she went into a frantic dance, twisting and parrying, lightsaber intercepting the darting thud bugs as they came at her in rapid succession. Yeoman Carr's laugh turned into a growl as he nearly emptied his bandolier, a dozen thud bugs darting and spinning at Mara. Her glowing blade worked in a furious, humming blur, whipping up high and to the side, down low, and when she couldn't catch up to that low-flying missile, she deftly hopped it, and then back up, connecting with one zooming creature barely a centimeter from her face. She turned about and sliced across, picking two out of the air, then dropped into a squat, the lightsaber flashing up above her head to take out a diving bug, then swishing down to the side, forcing another to alter its course. It tried to turn about, but had too much momentum, and smashed into the back wall, crashing in deep. Mara spun about to face Yeoman Carr, dived into a forward roll to regain her balance and to avoid any forthcoming attacks. Her lightsaber was at the ready as she came up, but the next missile plopped down, harmlessly, Mara believed, a couple of meters in front of her. The armored warrior leapt forward, landing perched on the railing in front of the woman. She started forward to meet his charge, lightsaber working against the movements of his staff. The gooey pie on the floor before her expanded suddenly and grabbed at her feet. Quick as any felinoid, sensing the movement, Mara launched herself into a back flip and then another. But the goo spread to pace her and caught her by the feet, rushing to encompass her ankles and hold her fast. Yeoman Carr howled in apparent victory. Mara's lightsaber swished down, cutting through the goo easily, separating it into two parts. But each of those parts continued to move, grabbing stubbornly. "You'll not defeat it," Yeoman Carr promised, and indeed, each passing moment and each passing movement brought both the jellies up higher on her legs, trapping her even more. R2-D2 wheeled out into the hall, aware of what was happening with Mara and knowing well that there was nothing he could do to help her directly. But Luke could, the droid understood, and so he wheeled down the corridor, squealing and clicking. A security holocam mounted high on the wall gave him an idea, and he rushed to the wall, knocking clear the security console and whirring through the codes, tapping into cam after cam, until he spotted Luke, scrolling through some screens on a computer in a private room. Accessing a complete diagram of the station, R2-D2 soon isolated the room and off he went, still screeching and beeping. The goo grabbed at Mara, but despair surely did not. She kept her head and her cool and moved her lightsaber through a wild blur of motion, slashing, cutting, the tip even brushing against her pants leg as she sliced the gel from her body. On and on she went, seemingly wild but actually precise, so much so that she soon had the goo chopped up into little pieces, and she still kept the presence of mind to arch her blade back out in front to intercept yet another thud bug zooming for her. The warrior came on, staff sweeping down, and Mara ducked at the last moment, came up tall and sent her lightsaber up high with a rolling motion that kept the staff out wide. Yeoman Carr dropped to one knee and brought his staff horizontally above him, hands out wide to intercept. Mara fully expected that her powerful lightsaber would shear through the staff and end the fight abruptly. But amazingly, the tattooed warrior's weapon caught the lightsaber, accepting the brunt of the hit without apparent damage. And Yeoman Carr twisted his hands to the side as he came up fast, throwing Mara's blade off aim. She should have stepped back to regroup, but the jelly, the many tiny jellies, still held one of her feet firmly, and she could only twist back so far, and not far enough for her to bring her lightsaber in to parry. Yeoman Carr stabbed with the snakehead end of his weapon, and to Mara's horror, that head opened wide its maw, fangs dripping venom. She slapped her hand inside the angle of the blow against the shaft just below the head, and was quick enough to retract it as the snakehead turned in to bite at it. The lightsaber's glowing blade swooped in an upturning circular parry between the two, forcing Yeoman Carr back, and with that moment of pause, Mara slashed it down beside her foot again, cutting in half the last piece of jelly large enough to hold her. Then she leapt back, though not far. It was as if she had wads of gum stuck to the bottoms of her feet. "You are worthy," Yeoman Carr congratulated, and started to nod and use the ruse to swing about quickly, his staff elongating and becoming supple suddenly, more a whip than a bludgeoning weapon. Mara tried to leap back, but the jelly, still grabbing at her, slowed her down. She pivoted to the side, bringing her weapon out to intercept. The whip snapped around the lightsaber, a strike so perfectly aimed that the head still came in across the woman's arm, fangs cutting deep scratches. Yeoman Carr howled in victory, but Mara took the burning hit, focused her energy suddenly on that part of her body, and forced a blood rush out of the wound, washing away the poison before it could begin to take hold. She accepted then that this opponent possessed weapons that she could not anticipate, and so she went on the offensive immediately, charging ahead and launching a series of thrusts and slices that had Yeoman Carr backing, and all the while he tried to retract his weapon to staff form to give him something with which to parry. But his retreat was short-lived. He flicked one hand in a reverse movement, sending the remaining length of whip ending in that wicked snake head back out at her. She dropped her left knee down and back, pivoting away from the warrior, and brought her lightsaber in a rolling motion down and then stabbing back over her dipping left shoulder, a perfect angle to intercept the rushing snake head, the tip of her blade diving into its opening mouth. She came up in a rush, arm pumping and slashing, tearing the snake head apart, and then she bore on right up to the large warrior. His backhand got inside her movement, though, the other hard end of his weapon smacking her across the shoulder and knocking her to the side. She rolled with it, accepting the blow, and spun down low, swiping across at his knees. He leapt above the cut, and then again as Mara came across with a backhand, and then brought his weapon, now fully a staff again, down at her seemingly exposed head. Mara turned and brought her elbows flying up, her lightsaber coming across horizontally to intercept and hold the weapon at bay. Yeoman Carr did not relent, pushing down with all his strength, frightening strength to Mara, for indeed, she, even with all of her inner power and determination, could not hold him up. She reached into the force then, trying another tactic on the man, and then she nearly buckled, for there was nothing. That was the only way she could describe it, nothing. It was as if the Force was not a part of this warrior, as if he refused to acknowledge its existence in such a profound manner that it did not exist for him. Mara had to rely strictly on her fighting skills, pitting her speed and precision against this opponent's brute force. With a sudden, desperate twist, rolling her left hand over her right, she snapped the descending staff harmlessly down to the side and in front of her, and then she started up, thinking to come in at the warrior up high. But she had jelly on one knee, goo that halted her progress abruptly and nearly sent her sprawling to the floor. That proved fortunate for Mara, though, for Yeoman Carr reacted more quickly than she believed possible, straightening and slashing his staff across viciously, a blow that would have taken her across the head or neck if she had continued upward. Quick to improvise, she stabbed the warrior, who was as surprised as she by the fact that she was still down low, in the knee. Then, as he howled in pain, she slashed her lightsaber across, taking him out at the knees and dropping him hard on his back. He started to roll toward her, bringing his staff across for her head, but she had the tip of her weapon out in time, pointed at his breast, and his own momentum drove him into it, the lightsaber finding a crease in that magnificent plated armor where the blaster had not, puncturing the coat and Yeoman Carr's chest, poking into his heart. He froze in place, staring hard at Mara. "You are worthy," he said once more, and then he just stared at her, and it seemed again as if he somehow knew her. "Jedi," he whispered. That flicker of recognition went away. All light in Yeoman Carr's eyes faded, and he lay very still. The door burst open, and Luke came rushing in, a squawking R2-D2 hot on his heels. It all hit Mara then, the exertion, the wounds, and something about the very nature of this poisoned planet that tugged at her insides, as if this disease within her fed off the perversion that was Belkaden. "Get me out of here," she whispered to Luke, trying to rise. She needed his help, especially in cutting away the last of the stubborn jelly. "Finish the download," he instructed R2-D2 as he helped Mara into a chair. "Do you know who that was?" he asked her. And he moved to the dead warrior, inspecting the tattoos, the disfiguring wounds, the strange plated armor and weapon. "His name is Yeoman Carr." Mara shook her head. "I think he knew me," she said. And Luke gave her a curious stare, one she could not in any way answer. Luke went back to his inspection. "R2, bring up images of all the scientists," he instructed. "Let's see if this was one of them." The droid whistled and did as instructed, but none of the records showing those stationed on Belkaden bore any resemblance to this barbaric warrior. Luke looked back to the body and shook his head. "There must have been another species living on this planet," he reasoned, "or they invaded." The droid was finished soon after, and the three left the control room, with Luke carrying the heavy warrior over his shoulder, and Mara, unsteady on her feet, carrying his staff and using it for support. They got to the Jade Saber without incident, and Luke settled the exhausted Mara into place. "Will you two be all right for a few minutes?" he asked. Mara looked at him, surprised, but then nodded. "We've got to find out," Luke explained. "He had weapons we don't know of," Mara told him. "Living missiles. And the stubborn jelly. And that staff," she said, indicating the snake-like creature. "There may be other enemies." Luke nodded and started away. "And Luke," she finished, "I could not use the Force to gain any insights on him. It might be some kind of training against Jedi tactics. If he has allies similarly trained, they'll be upon you before you expect it if you try to sense them." Luke paused, considering the information. "Get the ship into the air," he decided. "Run a guard for me over the compound, and be ready to blast open holes in the wall if I call to you." "Will the communicators even work?" Mara asked. "Let's see," Luke said, and he exited the Jade Saber. Once outside, he called through his comlink, and though the signal was weak and full of static, Mara and R2-D2 could indeed hear him. Luke went back into the station cautiously, while R2-D2, with help from the exhausted Mara, put the Jade Saber into a sentry pattern just above the compound. Luke returned a short time later, having completed his search, bearing a sack bulging as if it had two Taikawaka kicking balls inside. Mara looked at him curiously. "I found them in room B7, Luke explained, looking to R2-D2, who ran a quick check on his downloaded schematics and brought the name Yeoman Carr up across the view screen. Luke reached into the bag and pulled out a brown leathery item that looked like a ridged ball. "A helmet?" Mara asked. Luke shrugged. "I found just these two on a shelf in the closet," he explained, and then he looked at his wife hard. "I think they're alive." Mara, having witnessed a living staff and apparently living jelly, was not overly surprised. "Put them in a safe place," she replied. "They're probably bombs." Luke started to chuckle, but realized almost immediately that she wasn't kidding. He took the bag and its contents to a strong locker at the back of the Jade Saber's bridge and closed it up tight. The departure from Belkaden was no easier or smoother than the entry, and it quickly became apparent to Luke that his wife was not faring well. Even after they had cleared the clouds and broken out of Belkaden's turbulent atmosphere, Mara's face remained blanched, and her head lolled about weakly. "Did he hurt you?" Luke asked.
"No."
Luke stared at her, his concern clear on his face.
"It was just being there," Mara tried to explain. "I started feeling worse as soon as we neared Belkaden, down there." She paused and shook her head helplessly. "It was as if this disease within me was somehow bolstered by the plague affecting the planet."
"And the beetles?" Luke prompted, nodding toward the two specimen jars Mara had put on a shelf at the side of the control console. His wife picked up the one containing the living beetle, bringing it right before her eyes. "You believe they somehow caused the damage to Belkaden," Luke remarked. Mara looked at him, having no practical response, no real evidence.
It was just a feeling, a slight sensation, that these creatures were simply too foreign. And it was a feeling that Luke surely shared. But could it all, Belkaden, the beetles, the barbaric warrior, Mara's illness, be somehow connected? And what about Mara's insistence that this warrior was somehow devoid of, or rather, unconnected to, the Force? Hadn't she just had a similar experience with another, a troublemaker in a civil war? "The man I fought, Yeoman Carr," she began, again shaking her head at a loss. "I don't know if it's me, if this illness has caused some holes in my sensitivity to the Force, or if..." "Just like you said about the Romamulian rebel, Gnome Anor," Luke prompted, and Mara nodded. "I couldn't sense a thing with either of them." "But didn't you say that Jaina and Leia shared your perceptions of Gnome Anor?" "Or maybe they were just reading my own failings," Mara reasoned. "Maybe I was projecting something, some kind of a Force shield over the Romamulian, even as I was trying to read him." Luke let it go at that, but he didn't believe the explanation at all, and neither, he could tell, did Mara. Something very strange was going on here, something bigger than Belkaden or the Romamulian rebel, something that might even have implications for Mara's illness. He could feel it. They turned as one, hearing a voice behind them. At first, they thought it was R2-D2, but the droid was in place, still running his analysis on the multitude of downloaded files. The voice came again, from the closed locker, and while the first part of the speech was too garbled to decipher, both Luke and Mara thought they heard the name Carr clearly. Luke ran to the locker and pulled it open, then brought forth the bag and dumped it onto the floor. And then he jumped, and Mara cried out in surprise and horror at the disembodied head that seemed to have replaced one of the leathery balls. "Torig Bauk, Yeoman Carr," the head said. Neither Luke nor Mara recognized the language. "Dawin to Gu." "It's not real," Mara observed, moving over, even nudging the thing a bit to upright it. While the specific features of the head did not resemble the warrior she had recently battled, the scarring and the tattooing looked similar. The head said something else they could not comprehend, lips and eyes moving as if it was indeed the actual speaker. One phrase jumped out at them, the voice inflection seeming to give it great importance. "Preterite Vong." As it finished speaking, the leathery bag inverted suddenly, rolling back in on itself, and appearing again exactly like the other one. "A hologram recording," Mara remarked, daring to prod the seemingly lifeless thing again. "For Yeoman Carr," Luke agreed. "From his superior, is my guess." "These are communication devices, then," Mara reasoned. "But for whom?" "Did you get all of that, R2? Luke asked, and the droid beeped affirmative. "Can you translate?" Mara asked. "Ooh," R2-D2 replied sadly. 3PO will figure it out," Luke insisted, "once R2 can transfer the information to him." Mara nodded. "The Preterite Vong?" Luke mused. "What's going on?" Luke didn't have any answers for that one. "R2, have you got anything on space activity near Belkaden yet?" he asked the droid. R2-D2 whistled and clicked something in response. "Check the charts of the last few days for incoming or outgoing ships," Luke suggested. R2-D2 whistled and clicked the same pattern again, and this time Luke understood that the droid was trying to show him something. He and Mara moved over beside R2-D2, and immediately an image came up on the small view screen atop the droid's work pod, a replay of X-Gal-4's tracking of the super-speeding comet streaking in from outside the galaxy. Luke blew a sigh and wondered then if they should go back to Belkaden to see if there might be other evidence they had missed. "Fast forward it to conclusion," he instructed R2-D2, and they followed the course of the comet across the sectors until it was lost from view. R2-D2 brought up X-Gal's determinations about its course, the fourth planet of the Helska system. Luke and Mara watched it all in disbelief, with too much to digest, too many possibilities, and none of them adding up in a good way. Luke directed R2-D2 on what to search for, then went back to the pilot chairs with Mara and laid in a course for the fourth planet of the Helska system. The ice of that fourth planet seemed a tomb to his heart, a cold encasing eternal torment for the Jedi Knight. Miko sat curled in the lichen-lighted and heated chamber, head down in his arms, an attempt at meditation that would not come, the road to freeing emptiness blocked by the barrier of horrible recollections. He saw that maw, the chewing, pointy teeth, and felt the great power of the Yamask overwhelming him, mocking him, and all of his Jedi training. Nothing he had ever known in all his life could have prepared Miko for the tactics and devious techniques of the Yuuzhan Vong mind-breaking. In his training, he had faced the dark side of the Force, the specter of his innermost horrors, but even that paled beside the reality of the Yamask. How many times had the horrid creature feigned his execution? How many times had he been drawn in to within a hairbreadth of those chewing teeth? And each time, no matter what logic might yell at him, he could not believe other than that this would be the moment of his death. That reality did not get any easier with repetition. And worse, each feigned execution replayed in his mind 1,000 times, and each of those recollections seemed nearly as vivid as the actual experience. He could not sleep, could barely force down enough food to keep himself alive. Across the chamber, Danny watched it all helplessly, knowing that her companion was near to breaking. She had tried everything to comfort him, had held him while he thrashed in his dreams, had offered him her words of comfort and her shoulder to cry on. But it didn't matter, she knew. These Yuuzhan Vong warriors, whoever they were, had clearly decided, for some reason that escaped Danny Kui, that Miko, the Jedi Knight, was not worthy. And so they were going to destroy him utterly, his heart first, then his mind, and finally his body. And she could only watch.